Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the second part of our 2016 Aid Evaluation Forum, which looked at the evaluation of the Australia Awards and their impact on women's leadership.
So as Stephen said, I'm the Acting Assistant Secretary at the moment. Now, I did see Peter Vasigi here a couple of minutes while he's outside. So Peter is the incoming new head for ODE. We were very fortunate to have the leadership of Derek Rukin Smith for about 4 years. Derek retired just at the end of last month. So next time at this forum, you'll see Peter up here. I think Peter's well known to a number of you. So this morning we're going to hear from my friend and colleague, Dr. Karen Ovington. Karen's been in the Office of Development Effectiveness for several years now, and certainly by our standards is a prolific author of quality evaluation reports. And then we will hear from Cheryl Johnson. Cheryl is the Assistant Secretary for the Scholarships and Alumni Branch, and she'll, I guess, provide DFAT's perspective on the evaluation and let us know a little bit about how DFAT intends to respond to the recommendations. And finally, Dr. Rose Amazon from the University of New England School of Education. Rose has travelled down from Armidale to be with us, so thank you for coming all that way. So we have about 20-25 minutes for Karen, then 15 minutes each for Cheryl and Rose, which will then leave us with some time for question and answer. So thank you, Karen.
Building women's leadership is a priority for the Australian Aid Program. Since the first Colombo Plan in the 1950s, a substantial proportion of Australia's ODA has been directed towards scholarships. Now, scholarships have served a variety of functions, but amongst them is building women's leadership. And I've got some statements I've taken out of the documentation there about the role that they play in supporting leadership. Now, in all of these slides I've got on the screen, there's women from developing countries who have been supported by Australia Award scholarships to become leaders in their own countries. There's just one exception to that, which you'll see as I go on. Now, for this evaluation, we deliberately defined women's leadership very broadly, and that is as a process of women mobilising people and resources in pursuit of shared and negotiated goals within various sectors. I've simplified the evaluation questions and taken out one of them just for the purposes of this talk. We were interested in looking at the first question: do Australian Award scholarships support women's leadership? And if they do, how do they do that? And then, importantly for DFAT, we're interested in looking at how could scholarships better support women's leadership. I'm just going to very quickly go through the methodology we used. We looked at the tracer study data, so we had a quantitative analysis and we also did a qualitative analysis. In tracer studies, alumni are asked questions about what they have done after they return home. A lot of effort has been put into tracer studies recently, and a lot of work has improved the standardisation of the questions. The consequence of that is we were enabled to do a cross-country analysis of over about 20 countries, and the sample size we had for our analyses was often in the thousands. So it's a substantial source of evidence. We supported the quantitative analysis with qualitative analysis, and we interviewed about 140 alumni in the course of the evaluation. And we made a point of interviewing alumni who had only recently returned to their home countries, and we're defining that as in the last 3 years, or alumni who had completed their studies in Australia many years ago and were now in very high-profile positions. We also interviewed men who had studied in Australia, and because in all of this work looking at the impact of scholarships, attributing the findings to the completion of the scholarship is difficult, we also try and verify the findings, the statements of the alumni. We also interviewed workplace colleagues and workplace supervisors. The final group we spoke to were DFA staff who administer the scholarship program and also staff of managing contractors. Now, the next few slides I'm going to show you are data from the TRACER studies. In all of these, purple corresponds with women and green is men. A first step in building leadership is advancing in your careers. And so what is shown here is the proportion of men and women who are in a higher position on their return home. Down the bottom is the workplace, going from the public sector to civil society organisations. And the bottom, the darkest shaded region of each column, is the percentage of men or women who are in a higher position when they returned home. There's two things I just want to note from this. Men and women returning to both the civil society and private sector tended to be promoted to a greater extent the women returning, or men returning to the public sector. And regardless of the workplace, men were slightly more likely to be promoted than women. I should just mention too that when we spoke, we actually spoke to people about the promotions and reasons why the promotion occurred following scholarships. And it was a consistent view that having studied overseas allowed people to jump a few steps in their careers. If they were starting a career, they started at a higher level. If they were already employed, they jumped a couple of steps on the career ladder. And that, the explanation for it was that the skills and experience they gained overseas were invaluable to the workplace. Also, another big factor was improved English was a contributor to their progression in the organisation because it was a much needed skill. Another component of leadership is having increased responsibility. And here we're looking at the level, proportion of women and men who have increased financial responsibility and technical or operational responsibility. What you see is that about half of women who return have increased financial responsibility, and then this goes up from when those who have only been home for 3 years to those overall. And again, men see slightly higher rates of increases in financial responsibility. Increases in technical or operational responsibility were much greater, and really they didn't go up much over time, suggesting that the increases are largely related to the skills that were learnt during the scholarship. Now, in all of these, I should mention that we are in the TRACER studies, alumni are asked to what extent they attribute the changes to their completing a scholarship. And consistently, it was about three quarters of both men and women said the changes were due to their scholarship to a moderate or a high degree. Another component of leadership is supervising staff, and we can see in this that between 50 and 70% of women, this is only women on this slide, supervise more staff after their scholarship, and this is pretty similar across the different range of employment. what sort of skills do women pass on to those they're supervising, and also in that's in, shown formally or also informally. And we see along the bottom there a whole variety of types of information and skills are transferred to others following the completion of a scholarship. So we have the technical skills, but also more general things like leadership skills, research skills, and work practices and thinking skills. Now, I'm just going to move slightly away from the tracer study data to more information that was derived from the interviews. It's well known that the first part of becoming a leader is seeing oneself as a leader, and scholarships were critical in this process. We found that, especially for women from resource-poor settings or early in their careers, the experience of living and studying overseas was particularly transformative. And this was for a variety of reasons. Women told us they learnt a whole range of skills and work practices that helped them in their careers. We also were told that by the women themselves and also by colleagues and supervisors in the workplace that they had a great range of attributes that enabled them to become leaders. And these, the ones that were frequently cited were independence, confidence, self-belief and open-mindedness. And I've got a quote here from a supervisor in a workplace in the public sector in Lao PDR. "There is a difference for women who study in their home country. They are less outspoken, less confident, and don't feel fully confident to express their opinion. Women who have studied overseas are very confident. They are independent." The other thing we were told was that a critical result of having lived in a developed country was developing a vision that the women could use in their leadership roles when they returned home. And this, by being in, living and working in a developed country, they could see how systems could work better. And they gave us a whole variety of examples of ways in which their vision had been changed. How education is delivered and types of teaching methodologies, how you structure service delivery to reach the most disadvantaged in community, how you establish systems of infrastructure that work and are accessible to people with disabilities, how citizens can hold governments to account, and also women's leadership. And a significant number of the women we spoke to mentioned Julia Gillard. They had studied in Australia at the time she was Prime Minister, and they saw this as inspirational. Now I'm going to go on to the recommendations. So what I'm going to do is quickly outline the main findings that led to each recommendation. For quite a number of years, globally, Australian wards have been, scholarships have gone to as many women, if not more, as men. However, when you look at a country level, there are a number of countries where the allocation of scholarships to women is below that to men. Now, on this map, there's countries in which less than 50% of women were awarded scholarships, as shown. And I just want to draw your attention to a couple of these where there's a large scholarship allocation. So, in particular, Nepal and Cambodia. Now, why is this? Well, speaking to women, we were repeatedly told about the difficulty they had in securing Australian award scholarships. A photo there is Butet Manarang, who I'm going to use to illustrate this. She repeatedly applied for an Australian Award scholarship and was unsuccessful. This was despite the fact that she had already established a well-respected NGO. She'd won a UNESCO Man of the Biosphere Award. She was Time Magazine's Hero of Asia, and she also won the Asia Young Leaders Award. Still, she couldn't get an Australian Award scholarship. Now, even in countries where you would think it would be difficult to make sure 50% of women, 50% of scholarships are going to women, gender equity has been reached. And what the work that's been done over many years in Pakistan is a good example of this. In Pakistan, there's been a positive discrimination in that the English requirement for women has been reduced. And also there's been outreach activities to a whole variety of organisations to increase the number of women applicants. And when these women have got scholarships, there's not been any difference in the outcomes so that they've achieved. Because of this, we came up with quite a strong recommendation that in all countries where at least where there are at least 10 scholarships awarded annually, 50% of them should go to women. There was also an addition to it that if that target can't be reached, the number of scholarships allocated to men should be reduced until parity is reached. And we came up with that recommendation after talking to people who had worked on the scholarship program in Fiji, who told us that they consistently had very few women put forward for scholarships. They reduced the number available to men, and the next year, surprise, surprise, there was plenty of women who were suitable to be awarded scholarships. The other part of the recommendation is we think that the selection criteria should be revised to make women better able to receive scholarships. Now, leadership potential is already a selection criterion, but our argument is that leadership shown to date should also be a selection criterion. I just want to move on to targeting. I've just got some data from Indonesia to try and illustrate the point, the recommendation. So the top pie is the percentage of scholarships allocated to various categories. All of the blue ones are targeted allocations. The turquoise colour is scholarships allocated to a particular development sector, and these are scholarships that are largely people for these are nominated by posts, and they're usually in priority areas. The second area, 25% is a targeted region, and in Indonesia there's five of these. They're called geographic focus areas, and the bottom is targeted agency. Now in Indonesia these are 13 public sector agencies, and you see that overall about 75% of scholarships are targeted. That leaves only 24% open to all who want to apply. And then when you look at where those scholarships go to, 10% of that 10 out of the 24% go to women who are applying in the open category but working in the public sector, which leaves only 14% for other women not in the public sector. Now, if you look at the pie at the bottom, it's sort of flipped. Here, the largest sector is open, so that's the category of the number of women applying in the open category. What is really interesting is if you look at the proportion of these women who are not in the public, not working in the public sector, you see there's 54%. Now, in this other category, women vastly outnumber men in terms of applications. If you put these two graphs together, what you see is success rates for candidates. So for the targeted areas, see the success rates are much higher, from over 25% to almost 15%, whereas in the open category, success rates are incredibly small. About 5% for women applying in the open category in the public sector, but for other women from civil society, progressive civil society organisations, private sector, the success rate is only 2%. I've got a quote here that I liked. I should preface this by saying women told us that they had moved to geographic focused areas, provincial areas, because it increased their chance of getting a scholarship, or they had moved to work in a key agency in order to get a scholarship. And there's a quote here from a woman who did just that. I'd just like to note that she moved to the public sector, but then when we interviewed her, she was back working in the private sector. So we're... now, another thing, if you think back to the TRACER studies, the rate, the probability of a woman being promoted on return was greater if she worked in the private sector than if she worked in the public sector. We also found that it was harder for women in the targeted regions to progress into leadership positions. So therefore, it's also harder in some of the priority development sectors, such as the extractive industries in Africa, for women to progress. Therefore, the categories that are targeted are often those in which it's harder for women to become leaders. And as I showed you in that other slide, it's very hard for women working for progressive civil society or private sector organisations to win scholarships. As a result of these findings, we suggested that half of scholarships should be open to all candidates and that consideration should be given to allocating a small proportion of scholarships to men and women working in support of building women's leadership. Now, as I said at the start, scholarships have a whole variety of... Australian awards serve a whole variety of functions. Recently, there's been a shift in Australian award funding away from scholarships to short course awards and fellowships. In some settings, this is clearly appropriate, and it's also appropriate because of the different roles this funding's serving. Some countries like Indonesia have well-developed tertiary education systems of their own and well-funded domestic scholarship schemes for overseas tertiary studies. So, I mean, the transition could be... this shift in funding could be appropriate in such settings. However, our argument is that short courses are unlikely, because of their very nature, to be as transformative and leadership-building as scholarships. Short courses are group activities, they're highly structured and they're short term. Now, while short courses are cheaper, costing on average about $5,000 per week per participant, they're still fairly expensive. So you have a 3-week short course might cost $15,000, whereas the scholarships are more expensive, but when you do a comparison, they're not that much more expensive. Also, we were a bit alarmed to see that to date, women have been underrepresented in the short courses. I've just got some figures there for reviews that were done for Indonesia and Africa, with women sitting around as 40% of the participants of the short courses. Having said that, though, there are short courses, and there was one recently run in Indonesia for women who are civil society leaders. So short courses could have the capacity to support women's leadership. Our recommendation is therefore that DFAT should use different types of awards in addition to scholarships to build women's leadership, but that all types of Australia awards need to be held to the same gender equity targets as the scholarships and the performance framework for the aid program. Australian award funding is used for a variety of supplementary activities as well as supporting the scholarships and awards. We looked at some of these and the contribution that they do make to leadership. We found no evidence that women's leadership is increased by institutional targeting, leadership training while scholars are on ward, having a workplace reintegration plan or alumni associations, and I can discuss that more in more detail later if you want. And there was some evidence that other supplementary activities, such as leadership training at home after awards did help, and that we found that there was the recent online Africa Women's Leadership Network was holds some promise. Therefore, we recommended that DFAT needs to work to explore other options for post-leadership development for women and to build male supporters of women's leadership. The management of the Scholarship and Australia Award program is largely devolved to posts, and this is appropriate because it provides the flexibility to respond to specific country contexts. But what it means is that lessons aren't adequately shared. I can illustrate this by the tracer studies. To get the data to do our analysis, we had to actually go to each country post, and in some cases we had to actually go to the managing contractors to get the data. Our contention is that the tracer studies are a key component of the monitoring and evaluation of scholarships, and therefore the data needs to be held and analysed centrally. When we looked at the questions in the tracer studies, we realised that they could be improved if you want to get better assessments of leadership outcomes. For example, the questions ask, have you been promoted? There is no qualification on that. There's not, have you been promoted X times in a certain period of time? It's just, have you been promoted? So obviously, the longer a person's been home, the less relevant that becomes in assessing progression in leadership. Also, some of the analyses that have been done of the tracer studies haven't been gender disaggregated. Okay. So our recommendation was that the tracer studies should be reviewed, and there should be a specific focus on leadership outcomes, and that the scholarships and alumni branch should establish processes to share knowledge between country programs. And finally, just to sum up, our finding is overall that Australian Award scholarships are strongly building women's leadership, and they're particularly transformative for some women. However, we felt that there was a greater capacity to use scholarships to build women's leadership. Our final recommendation was therefore that DFAT should continue to invest in scholarships and make building women's leadership an explicit goal of scholarships. Thanks.
Thank you, Karen. Cheryl, just wanted to invite you up, please.
Sorry? No, just in a minute. Thank you. Won't be too long. Okay, well, thank you for inviting me to provide the DFAT response to the evaluation that Australia Awards contribute to building leadership amongst women. I'd like to start this presentation off with just a personal example, if you can indulge me for a moment, before I go on to how we're going to respond to the findings of the report. On the 9th of March, I attended the International Women's Day event at Barangaroo in Sydney. I don't know, probably some of you were there. There was 1,200 people. It was a very large event. And I had the pleasure of hosting one table of 9 Australia Awards women who were invited to that event to experience what it was like to celebrate women's achievements and to have a vision. Our Minister, Julie Bishop, was the keynote speaker. She had 40 minutes and she went on a journey through her leadership challenges and her vision for leadership going forward, both in Australia and internationally. What was fantastic was in the middle of that very important speech, she asked those 9 women to stand up in front of 1,200 people to be acknowledged as women who are strong and determined future leaders in our region. I can't tell you what that did to the nine women. They got up, they were very shy, they were in national dress, and they received a resounding round of applause in that particular event. That was a wonderful thing for me to experience, but it was also a fantastic thing for them to experience. At my table was a lady called Janet Boulamaris, and she was an impressive woman from PNG. And she's working for a PhD in education at the University of Sydney. She's got a dream for her country and PNG's education system. She's passionate, and my goodness, she oozes personality. She's one of the happiest women I think I've ever met. She has optimism, and she's an Australia Award recipient. And I'd like to just show you, it's only a minute and a half, here's what she's got to say about her experience here in Australia, and hopefully the PowerPoint gods work.
My name's Janet. I've been studying at the University of Sydney, and I'm currently doing my PhD in higher education. Since I came in 2004, I have been a volunteer with St. Vincent de Paul, and it's been one of the highlights where I have gone out to communities to help people in need, and it's my way of saying thank you to the people of Australia for the scholarships that I have received. Yeah. The student contact office has been helpful for me in various ways, like helping me academically to the support that I can access on campus and other services around university, and also connecting with the outside community. My advice to potential students applying for the Australian Awards is that it is one of the best awards, in that it supports you very well in studying in Australia academically and also in living in Australia. Also, it is one of the best awards because it is targeted. It's targeted to developmental area and priorities back in your country. And I think that those are the best essences that I can think of for the Australian Awards. Yeah. I will have a different approach to my work when I get back home in the areas of working with people and seeing things differently from different perspectives, laterally from multi-diverse diverse perspective, and also engaging, like an inclusiveness that I'd like to try out when I get back.
She's a very inspirational woman, and I have no doubt she'll go back and do something very positive in PNG and their education system. So now I'll move on to what the management response is. So it's important to understand that the Australia Awards scholarships, the long-term awards, are part of a broader suite of Australia Award modalities, and they give, in a different way, across those modalities, the opportunity for individuals from developing countries to come and undertake some tertiary study in Australia, either over a long period of time, or 2 years or 3 years, but also some shorter periods of time, over 4 weeks and maybe 12 months under our fellowship scheme. So in 2015, DFAT committed $370 million to the Australia Awards program. It's a big program. We've got about 4,000 new awardees from about 87 developing countries. And I have to tell you, we are proud of the fact that we've got 54% of scholarships that are awarded to women in 2015 alone. And they're study undertaken in education, governance and health. So the evaluation outcomes. Look, we welcome this evaluation and we support the findings about empowering women's participation in leadership. Can I just say from a personal perspective, I've got over 20 years experience across the public service, and evaluations are simply opportunities. We get to be guided on where we need to go. I get power in negotiating changes that need to happen, and I get to talk to country programs about, well, the ODE study found this, the ANO study found this, other audits found this. We have to lift our game. There is no criticism as far as I'm concerned. It's about positivity and moving on. The report actually recognises the positive successes of the program. We know that scholarships are a life-changing experience. They get to live in Australia, they get to experience our way of life and our values, and in gender issues, that is really important. They're in an environment, finally, that fosters and encourages innovation, independent thinking. They get involved in experiences. She was involved in St. Vincent de Paul. She was doing something in Australia that a lot of us in our room perhaps don't do. You know, that wonderful experiences that they have. Educational experiences generally acknowledge as one of the most powerful influences of lasting attitudes. We not only build the future leaders, I think it's also important to think about Australia Awards as connecting globally with other countries, with other women, with other sectors, and also they have a relationship with Australia for a lifetime. So where to from here? Well, the evaluation is very timely as far as we're concerned. We've for the first time developed a whole program called the Australia Awards Global Strategy that sets out our goal of global programs and why DFAT invests in Australia Awards. You might think, well, is this the first time we've had this strategy? The answer is yes. This program has been going for 50 years. And it's evolved, it's changed names, it's been country developed, it's been shaped, etc. We've had politicians come in and now we're calling it Australia Awards. And it's been driven internationally in regions and in countries. This is the first time we've stood back and said, globally, what do we want to achieve? Here, and I sit in Canberra and talk to posts all the time. And it's in these situations where we get to shape where we're going going forward. To put the scholarships into context, I think you need to understand that Australia Awards long-term are just one modality. We have our short course program, which we've discussed here already. We've also got our fellowship program. So we are a set of modalities that can deliver against a set of needs in a particular context. The other thing is Australia Awards scholarships, they're only one element of a country and regional program's strategies to address priority areas in the country and region, including women empowerment and gender equity. Country programs can add Australia Awards to their strategy as a modality to go forward. We are not the be-all and end-all. We need to be integrated with that broader program strategy. So what does this global program strategy look like? What I'm going to do is just give you a general overview, and then I'll get to more specifics about what that means in terms of the response to this report. So we're setting out strategic direction. We've got five principles of why we would invest in Australia Awards. Firstly, they need to align with Australia's development, economic and public diplomacy priorities. We've got a broader agenda now. I've got 5 minutes. We've got equity and access. I'll talk about that more in a moment. Merit-based selection. We want the people who can contribute to development countries. We want academic competence as well. We don't want people being stressed if they come to Australia and they don't have the competence. Value for money, strengthening our assessment of our partners, streamlining where we can, and most importantly, improving our data collection. And then that's been highlighted already. And we want to promote Australia Awards. So what does that mean? Which one have I got up there? So what does that mean for what we found in the report? We've got a particular focus on equity of access. We will, in our strategy, we have explicitly stated that we will maintain equal numbers of awards for women at a global level, and we can talk about that more later. We're going to change the way we target these awards and broaden them out across government, civil society and private sector. That was a recommendation. We agree. We think it needs to be broadened. Moving away from allocating quotas and looking more broadly. We want to work with some of those posts that were up here about designing specific implementation and strategies for barriers to participation, women, people with a disability, etc. And we also want to make sure, outside of the scholarship, the equitable access to on-award and alumni activities. There are added things that we can get involved with. The fellowship and short course program, we can broaden their profile. To give you an example of what we're doing there, round 15 of the fellowship program, we funded 8 fellowships on gender development thematic areas across Africa, Asia and the Pacific. That had 120 women coming to Australia looking at women's empowerment, combating gender and violence, improving women's literacy, etc. The other thing we're doing, the Minister in the next couple of weeks is going to launch the alumni strategy. So what we're looking at is opportunities to work with women about how they actually engage when they get home. We're looking for mentoring. We're looking for issues that we can help them with when they go home. Sometimes that's conversations with employers and how to get the next job and how to be more influential in their community. The other thing I want to mention just quickly is we want to have a look at this issue of unconscious bias in selections. We're having a look around the world to see how we can have a look at that. We've had a look at Sweden, the Netherlands, the UK and New Zealand, and we think there's some things there that we can actually put in place around selections that will remove unconscious bias. So reporting and performance is obviously an area where we think we can improve. In terms of the tracer facilities, we're now setting up a global tracer facility, which will have a methodology that will go across the world looking for the same things and looking for the outcomes across the world. We've also provided guidance with countries until we get this study up and going, what are some of the parameters? So they're looking for the same things, and hopefully we can stop the issue of having this broad these broad findings. We're also going to implement an aid program performance report, which will draw on all the things that Scott has shown you just before, and we're going to pull out exactly how the Australia Awards are performing. The other thing that's a bit micro, but I'm going to mention it anyway, we're filming stories around men and women. We're deliberately going out there now, people who have returned home and filming their stories so that we can celebrate their achievements. And we've actually negotiated with the ABC Australia Plus service to actually promote and play those stories internationally. We're going to use their stories on the website. We're going to provide stories in the social media channels. So I think Australia Awards has gone a long way to empowering women. I think we've got some pretty cool initiatives that we can implement. And if I've got time, do I have another 1.3 seconds? Thank you. I wanted to leave you with another video. This time it's a woman who is young. She's still here in Australia. She's still studying. And I just want you to hear the passion in her voice. She's from Sri Lanka. And I've got 100 of these stories. Hundreds.
I was always thinking, how can I serve back to my country? So they have offered me a sponsorship to attend last year the 5th University Scholars Leadership Symposium in Cambodia. I have initiated a project called Care for Sri Lanka. So we got shortlisted in that symposium and we had to present it in front of 800 delegates. So you have Australian degree in my resume, give me great leadership opportunities when I'm applying for the firms back in Sri Lanka. It will be really recognized.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cheryl, and welcome, Rose.
Thanks for this. All right, let me get started because I think my time has started already. Thank you so much for having me here. My sort of adjective I'm going to use today is excitement. Excitement because there hasn't been a report that looked at these before, and excitement that what the report is revealing is true, that the Australian Awards Scholarship does make a difference. It makes a difference not only to women but to men. And having a scholarship to study overseas for a lot of people in developing country is like having a pot of gold. It opens many doors, and it's sort of like something that keeps giving. And I just want to say, I don't think that's a doubt. I don't think that's anything that I would be questioning here today. Not at all. And actually, I would be even reinforcing. Where is my thing? I would be even reinforcing that point even more. Oh, sorry. Is it not working? Sorry. Thank you. Okay, great. So this is what I call the X factor. The X factor are many women and men who have Australia scholarships where they said it changes their life. It makes a massive difference in their lives. And of course, we are interested in leadership. And I get that. And I think I understand why the Australian government and many other government interested in, you know, how does the scholarship or whether the scholarship actually make a difference in terms of building leadership or improving women's leadership. Because there's a lot of research that show women in political roles have, there's a relationship between women in political roles and women's in leadership and other outcomes as well in terms of increasing community services such as sanitation, healthcare, and childcare and so on. So being interested in women leadership is important. However, I guess the big question that I have about this whole report is what sort of leap do we need to make between advancing contribution of women in terms of scholarship contribution to women's professional advancement? So what sort of leap can we make between that and the fact that we can say it contributes to leadership? Because it's not necessarily the case that we have a leader and it will automatically contribute. We can have a woman that advances in their career, but not necessarily be a leader or not necessarily make any sort of advancements that contribute to improving the livelihood of women. So again, as I said, I am 100% in favor of this. But the report itself said it is difficult to assess the extent in which completing a scholarship contributes to the professional advancement of alumni. So there's a lot of hole. So we can say, yes, women get promoted. Women do have a career advancement. But yet the extent in which that happened, there's a lot of gray there. So I could also say the positive professional outcomes. There's high unemployment that was stated in the report as well, high promotion of women. And again, all good things. There's no bad things there. But we also have to think about in terms of promotion, the sort of structures that's in place when women are being promoted. And a lot of time, it found that the private sector is where a lot of this is happening. So from our findings, we did research as well in this area, but we're looking mainly in how the scholarships contribute to public health in Africa. There's a group of us from Sydney Uni. We did a research around this. So whether scholarship, and my focus was on gender. So what sort of impact does the scholarship have on women that are returning and reintegrating back into the society back home? So what we found that was slightly different in terms of positive outcome is that many had difficulty finding jobs upon return, although the report said otherwise. Again, we're looking at country-specific and area and regional-specific, so there might be some difference there. But because certain areas are quite specialized, especially with the priority areas such as agriculture, public health, a lot of time when they return, it's very difficult to find specialized areas where they can actually grow professionally. And also we found that many had to move around many times to actually get a job they're satisfied with, a job that would give them satisfaction and growth. So it's not all rosy pictures. The other thing I want to point out in terms of the report stating that there's high employment and promotion is that there is an aspect of bonded, being bonded as well. So bonded is basically signing a contract that you would return in the place that you've actually left, because a lot of the scholarships are targeted to public sectors. So that wasn't really quite clear in the report, whether a lot of those people that did find a job, whether they were bonded. And I think that's something that could have been explored a bit more. Another good story I have is soft skills and attributes. And I think the report touched on this. This idea of building self-confidence is very, very important. And women definitely rave about this. Studying in Australia gives them that boost, and it's very important. So they do gain that. And we did find similar findings as well. And also having a degree overseas, there's a level of prestige about it as well, which again opens a lot of doors. So there are some good stories there. Now, I want to touch a little bit about the private and public sector discussion that was in the report, because it showed that a lot of the women were quite successful in the private sector. But I want to tell this story in terms of conducive and supporting environment within the public sector. So I know one of the recommendations that was made is to have sort of part of the scholarship being opened up so that not so much of it is targeted to the public sector. I don't quite agree with that, because I think in the public sector, you have a lot of issues, and there's a lot of people that actually need help to sort of grow this area. So I don't quite agree that we need to remove some of the scholarships and send them to the public sector, because privatizing that is not necessarily going to help. So if the purpose is about building capacity, then building capacity in the public sector is very important. So that needs to be part of the picture as well. So yes, I just wanted to put that out there. The other big one that I think is important to talk about, again, I'm only focusing on certain things, is alumni, the Alumni Association. And the report, again, touched on this. And I think it's a very, very important thing for many reasons. And I will outline it here. So I'm giving you the voices of the women. So I'm putting some of the quotes here from our study, because I think the voices, we need to listen to the people that this is being affected. We need to listen to the people that actually have returned, not only focusing on the good story, but also focusing on the challenges and barriers that they do face when they go back home, because it's real. It's real for them. So in terms of engagement with the alumni, that is one of the biggest thing we did find as well in our study, that networks, the sort of alumni network were more social. They were more social events, and they were sort of reminiscing about old time and good days. And a lot of times, you know, especially with women being time poor, they feel like, you know, they can get that socialization somewhere else. It's all good to talk about Australia and the good old days, but they wanted more. But also there was an expectation, I think, from the government, partly because it is being used as a diplomatic sort of platform. It is being used to sort of help people and women and men as well who wants to apply for the scholarship to help them out. But yet there's a lack of support there. So I absolutely agree in terms of using the short course trainings, the workshops, seminars, and so on to really help with sort of really forming this body of support, because I think that's highly needed. So some of the surprising findings I found, I'm only mentioning two here, is that, so throughout the report, it said private sectors embrace women. It gives an opportunity to sort of grow. It gives an opportunity to supervise people. It gives them many, many opportunities. But in the report, it also said that skill transfer in both the public sector and the civil society was better than in the private sector. I find this one quite interesting, because our studies sort of contradict that a bit. And other studies as well, not only our study, but research in other areas regarding this show that a lot of times, you know, it's quite the opposite. Another surprising finding, it said the level of support was consistently lower for women in the private sector compared to the public sector. Again, a contradiction really to some of the things that were presented throughout the report, raving about the private sector, how it's creating a space, an environment for women to have better opportunities and become leaders. Because I think, you know, this is sort of, there's a gap there. I'm not quite sure why that is. Now, moving on to this. Okay, this is, I think, the big elephant in the aid, and it's the big elephant, I think, in scholarships, this idea of barriers, but not only barriers, but structural barriers, whether the scholarship can actually do anything about that. So I was very happy to see some of the men included in there, but I was slightly disappointed to the extent in which they were. So men's views were slightly mentioned, I think, in passing more than anything. And there are some representation of their voices, but it is unclear how many men were interviewed from the various cases. I do not think, in addition to the tangible sort of positive nature of women, scholars, I think it is very important to engage men in this process. I think without men, I don't think it can happen. We talk about gender equality a lot. And a lot of times there's a focus on women, but I really think men play a massive role. And I think there needs to be a slightly more focus on how to bring them in. But I would have been very interested, again, to sort of reinforce this idea of how the scholarship process has the potential to change the view of men. And recognizing that would also recognize something very important. Because there is a tone in this report, I think, that recognizing I think it could have been better, meaning that women's lack of capacity is not the main cause for women not being leaders. I think that's a very important thing. And the tone of the report make it seem like if only these women could get up here, if only this could happen up here, then all would be fine. And I think the voices of men would really help with that. So we must think about what role of men in supporting women's leadership, in building women's leadership. Are there changes in their thinking and perhaps their behavior, in them participating in this scholarship? So I do applaud the report for discussing the structural barriers. So that was mentioned. So I think the acknowledgement of the existing disparity between men and women and supporting them to overcome the barriers therein the necessary starting point for successful achievement of equality for women. So creating equal opportunities for women is the cornerstone of bringing about lasting change in communities. So that bridge is really important. So it is important to address structural barriers because it forces us to confront complex issues regarding gender equality and pushes us to consider a very coherent and holistic approach to this. So leadership is not in a silo. It doesn't exist based on just women capabilities. It's much more than that. And there are a lot of structural barriers. Am I doing okay? All right, great. The scholarship programs themselves do not really engage with the structural conditions or with the concepts such as the inequality producing existing gender order. Perhaps the scholarship schemes cannot realistically reconfigure gender roles or the sexual division of labor in the recipient countries. I mean, that would be a miracle if it could. Maybe that is beyond their reach, the scope, or even or remit. That would be a very radical agenda if it was made an explicit aim. It would not easily fit with the prevailing discourse of official granting bodies. However, the act of providing some women with these otherwise unavailable opportunities might still set change in motion. So the structural barriers are real and they exist. And if we're expecting women, if we're expecting an outcome of the scholarship to be to have women leaders, then more needs to be done there. Certain gaps and certain things that I think were addressed, but I'll just mention them. So again, there was a leap of faith between the scholarship providing professional advancement to the scholarship sort of scholarship increasing leadership. Again, that wasn't quite clear to me in the report. So there's a focus on promotion and numbers, but it is not necessarily the case, as I mentioned before, that this would translate into leader being a leader, especially not knowing if these women had promotion opportunities before. And I think this idea of having a baseline or counterfactuals, you know, whether without the scholarship would the women still be leaders, is something that needs to be considered in the bigger scheme of things. Additionally, there's an assumption that women in leadership roles will promote and act in the best interests of women. So we are automatically assuming there, you know, these women, we just have to get them to be leaders and, you know, things will be good. Again, it brings us back to that structural barriers. So, you know, it's not necessarily true. I mean, Margaret Thatcher is a great example of that, you know, a woman that was in leadership, but not necessarily, you know. And a lot of women in leadership, too, there's a pressure, you know, they want to stay in power. So they have to somewhat sometimes agree and give in. So they have to compromise. And some of that, you know, is the interest of women sometimes. Now, I have to drop in the Africa in here because there was a mention of it, but it was quite superficial. I think the leadership, Women Africa, what is it? Africa Women Leadership Network is quite recent. And I think it was... there could have been better choices there. As I mentioned before, not clear in terms of how they establish a baseline, not knowing if there were promotion opportunities before, and the counterfactual factor, again, I'm not going to repeat. But again, it wasn't clear how did they isolate the influence of the scholarship from the other factors in the TRACES study analysis. And I'm glad they mentioned the idea of lack of standard in the TRACES study, because it's so inconsistent and it's so very difficult, it's so very different that it's very hard to have it, to sort of bring all of these pieces together and to have a coherent sort of analysis out of that. So I champion definitely having a more standardized global sort of way to trace some of that. Again, I don't think Africa was included in the TRACES studies. It wasn't quite clear whether Africa even has a TRACES study. So to end... I want to just bring up some of the silences in the report. So it is true that the scholarship are life-changing, transformative to women's lives in developing countries. However, are the scholarship empowering women of a particular social class? Again, this is an issue that I think was not covered in the report. Are scholars members of the elite? How does this affect leadership? So in other words, if they are we reinforcing existing social economic disparities in this country? And I think that is worth considering. Subject area was something that was mentioned, and I strongly agree, especially in the African context, that they prioritize agriculture and extractive, which indirectly skews gender ratios. So again, that needs to play part of the story when we look at reasons why there are low numbers of women participating. Part of it is because of the priority areas and subject areas that is selected. The other thing that I would have loved to see is what is being done in country cases selected to support women's leaders. So what are some of the policies, the country-specific cases that they actually use in the report that actually relate or interrelate with the DFAT gender equality policy? I think that would have helped a great deal. So to sum up, I will say that change in leadership and factors that impact this change is not easy to measure. And I don't know if a tracer study can measure it. I think a longitudinal sort of study might capture more aspects of it. So in order to identify and explore the changes in leadership roles of women, scholarships, and finding out what factors that appears to have contributed to those changes is not easy. And I don't have an answer. If I did, I think I'll be a millionaire by now. But at the same time, I think there are different factors and different side to the story that I think needs to be acknowledged. I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rose. Cheryl and Karen, thank you all. Just whilst our panellists take a seat, I might just mention that ODE will return to this evaluation later this year or next year. to essentially inquire as to how progress against the recommendations is going. And in fact, if you look on our website, you'll see a review on uptake of recommendations from the evaluations that were completed last year. And that shows, I guess, the progress that's been made against the recommendations. And if you like, it's a measure as to the usefulness of the work that ODE undertakes. So just as previously, if you could identify yourself and the organisation you represent and the first speaker and the first question in the middle there. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm David Lucas. I'm from the School of Demography at the ANU. I'm in search of the perfect statistical table, so I'd like to ask Dr. Hovington, I'll make a statement. I would have liked to have seen the numbers that are the base for your statistics, but more importantly, to what year do they relate? And I'm particularly asking this because of the fluctuation in African scholarships, which have risen to a great height and then fallen to a great height. And my other question is, what is the wastage in the tracer study? That is, people who do not go back to their home country, either because they've stayed in Australia or they've gone somewhere else. Thank you.
For the tracer, there's actually a table in the back which shows the report which outlines the tracer studies we looked at. There weren't any for Africa that we could use. And so what we did was we took the most recent trace study. So in some cases that was, I don't know, maybe 2013, in other cases it was earlier, and we used the data from that. In terms of the statistics, there are actually some statistics in the tables at the back in the appendix of the report. I'm not quite sure what else I could say about that. In terms of one big problem with the tracer studies is they become less relevant the longer a woman's been at home. And so what you do, you see a transition so that the biggest proportion of responses are from those who've returned relatively recently, and you get very few for women who've been back in their own home countries for maybe 10 or 15 or 20 or even 30 years. So that is a problem. So your analysis is skewed to most recent returnees who are not, you know, and that's at the stages when they're still in their early career development.
So can you give me a wastage figure?
Of the number of
people who don't go back at all?
You can answer that.
You need notice for this.
No, we have a unique visa number where they are required to go back for 2 years back to their country to contribute to development in whatever form they choose. But no, they don't stay on, and if they apply for another visa, they're in a debt to the Commonwealth, so it's pretty tough.
Oh, well, that's good to hear, because there was a time in the past when immigration sort of overruled Aussie as it then was, and people were allowed to stay on indefinitely.
And we're playing nicely in the sand pit now.
It's Therese, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, hi, thank you. I'm Therese Faulkner. I work with COFI on the Australia Awards Program in Indonesia. Just picking up on a comment picked up by Rose as well on the second recommendation that at least 50% of Australia Awards scholarships should be open. As pointed out, I think, by Karen, I think over 70% of the Indonesian scholarships are targeted. And I'm just making the observation that the scholarship program is used for a number of different objectives, including building institutional strength and capacity building, that sort of thing. So I have one question for Karen and perhaps one for Cheryl. For Karen, just wondering if there was any consideration given to other ways of increasing women's representation in the scholarships within targeted categories rather than making them all making 50% of them open. And maybe for Cheryl, whether the scholarships and alumni branch will apply that recommendation equally across all country programs, ensure that every country program has at least 50% of scholarships open, or whether that is more of a global target. Thank you.
I didn't really have time to go into it, but we did look at, the evaluation was just focused on women's leadership, so we've got to bear that in mind. We did look at this institutional targeting and whether it was effective. And the thinking is that if you can put enough Australian alumni in an organisation, you might be able to change the culture. And we basically found that in some cases, there's a very large numbers of alumni and they weren't having any effect at all because the senior management wasn't supportive. So the critical factor wasn't the number of alumni, but the management of the organisation.
Can I add to that? From our study, we found that critical mass is actually quite important if you have a leader that got a degree overseas. Yeah. So I'm not sure if that was something that was also looked at. Because building that critical mass, a lot of the alumni feel like they have the support and their supervisors actually understand where they're coming from when they bring up an idea or they want to change something within the organization.
On the question of the 50% in private sector, it's never an easy answer, I guess. I mean, around the world, we've got bilateral agreements and we've got bilateral relationships which have been, you know, worked on for years, and that there are some expectations in those relationships. But there is no doubt at all that we want to see a greater focus in some of those areas, and that's driven by Julie Bishop. She definitely wants to see an increase in capability in the private sector and in NGOs. So if we continue, for argument's sake, to continue focusing on 70% of the public sector, we're not meeting that requirement of government. That is what she wants to do. Are we going to apply a uniform 50%? No, I don't think it's possible. I think it does depend on the country context, but I do agree that it does need to be opened more.
I've got a question in regards to where do you think that Australian awards could, in some small way, kind of address some of the structural issues and the cultural biases against women in leadership? I think some things come to mind is something to do in the application process of maybe having something about women's leadership, or maybe even requiring everyone to go through some form of gender studies to help address some of those biases.
It's part of the global strategy. We are right up front in saying explicitly there has to be a gender objective, and how are you going to meet that in your design? And that includes in the selection process. And I mentioned just quickly around unconscious bias in those selection processes. And, you know, whether people mean to or not, sometimes they have a predisposition for a particular individual, for, you know, whatever. What we're trying to do is, well, how do you take that out, and what impact will that have on women coming forward more frequently in successful scholarships? So the fellowship rounds, we've absolutely got a requirement around gender and what are some of the partnerships that we can do. I like the idea of, are they going to do gender studies while they're here in Australia as mandatory? I've thought that, but I haven't been successful in pushing that through with all of the others. But I do think that's absolutely relevant, and particularly for me.
I'll just add the recommendation that we consider allocating a small proportion of scholarships to men or women who are working to advocate for change sort of fits in with what you're talking about, using scholarships to perhaps gradually influence the structural constraints for women in the countries where they've come from.
Thanks. So I think there was a question in the centre here, and then one from Sally.
Thank you. Margaret O'Callaghan, former UNFPA representative for 12 years, and I'll say it before that, and women's organisations before that, etc., etc. I'm going to play the devil's advocate because I feel very strongly about this subject, and I'm very upset about the Australian Aid Program's approach to it. And I'm going to just list 4 points. There won't be time to go into all of them. By the same token, of course, I recognise that the excitement, the thrill, the stimulation of, you know, coming to another country and studying, because it is terrific, there's no doubt about it, on an individual basis. But, first of all, I'm really shocked that the objective of the program is to meet Australia's gender quotas. You know, excuse me, I thought we were trying to help developing country women. Why aren't we our objectives aimed at meeting the country's needs, not ours? Secondly, what is the cost-benefit analysis of training one person in Australia versus 20 or 40 or 100 for the same price in their home countries, even though the benefits will be slightly different? Thirdly, the courses here in Australia don't necessarily, probably don't, address the needs back home. The PhD from PNG in education, she came back to UPNG, wrong country there. The conditions at UPNG are nothing like she would be seeing here. What sort of training is this? What sort of education is it? Can she apply the skills, the knowledge she's picking up here, back in the context of, for example, UPNG? It's a very different kettle of fish. If we're talking about both personal benefit and country benefit. And fourthly, the whole thing of selection of candidates. Now, maybe I missed the details on that, or they weren't, you know, there wasn't time to go into them. But there's a high risk of elite capture. And I've seen this time and time again. I've read hundreds and hundreds of CVs. And you see the same people go to 50 courses, 50 overseas trips, 50 this, that, and the others. And one example of that is I was shocked when I went back to PNG and back to Zambia after something like 5 to 10 years absence to find the same women in the senior positions. These women were my age, and they were still, you know, the leader of the women's bands. I was staggered. There was something was wrong with the system, that the same women were getting the same opportunities, and many, many more were missing out. So the whole subject of selection, to me, is very important.
So we might need a separate afternoon session too. But nevertheless, I'll invite the panel to respond as best you can in the limited time available.
Okay, I've got some responses. just on quotas and targets, it's interesting language. We argued strongly that we shouldn't have a quota, that we should have targets. And the reason we should have targets is because it is country-specific and it is about development of that country and it is about the context that the awards are in. So I probably need to say, no, we don't look at quotas, we are looking at targets. As far as the women are concerned, we have a 50% target, not a 50% quota by country, but we are going to trial that in the spirit of the evaluation. That has been a recommendation, so we thought we might trial that. That's all I've got to say on that. Does anyone else want to comment on targets and quotas?
I want to comment on the selection of candidates. I agree with you 100%. I mean, our own study also found this, that many of those that participate in the scholarship are from the elite group. They have many opportunities. They've been traveling all over. And not only that, they also have connections in higher people in higher position that gives them, help them to sort of get where they are. So this idea, if we are building capacity in leadership, we definitely need to consider how we select the women, what criteria are used for this. I agree.
Our last question, perhaps, from you, sir. You had a question?
Thank you very much, speakers. Very interesting. I'm familiar with the evaluation, having been involved in draft and management response. I'm particularly interested in the issue of quotas versus targets and the recommendation that if a country program couldn't achieve a 50% target, that there actually should be a quota imposed so that the number of scholarships overall be reduced. In other words, if there were more scholarships offered to men and women, and those scholarships be reduced to bring them into parity with the number of scholarships to women. And I think that that's a risky area, personally. I understand the argument in its favour, but I'd be very interested to know what the outcome of imposing that quota will be. So I'll watch that with great interest. And the second point is simply that in order to be able to measure the impact of Australia Awards on women's leadership, we really ought to also study the impact on men's leadership. And the other point is that if most of our awardees are in fact drawn from the elite, well, those are the people that are going to become leaders. And is that such a bad thing in that sense? If we are in fact trying to achieve empowerment, gender empowerment, then perhaps our approach needs to be rather different, and maybe we need to be measuring things slightly differently and not actually looking for leaders, but looking at how awards have actually impacted on the lives of women in a whole range of different ways. That's about it. So it's not really a question, it's more a comment.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Rose, Cheryl, Karen. Thank you all for attending. I'm just going to close. We have lunch. It's probably sitting outside now, so I will be as quick as I can. I just wanted to thank Stephen and the Development Policy Centre also. As Stephen noted earlier, we've been collaborating in this manner for several years now. Many of us spend months and sometimes years working on these evaluations, so it's a great opportunity to come and share what we've been working on. We're interested in our evaluations being used, and what we note is around about the same time that one of these events occurs, there's a spike in downloads from the website. So that's good for us. Speaking of our website, we've got a newsletter coming out very soon which highlights some of our more recent work. Please, if you're not already on that mailing list, head to the website and register. You will note also there that our work plan is on the website. So that tells you what we're currently working on, what you can expect to see in the near and medium-term future, and also provides you with a little bit of insight into how ODE decides what we're going to evaluate, because we cannot evaluate everything, and we certainly can't evaluate everything in a single year. The other thing just to note is that we're actually, Scott talked earlier in the day about improvements in aid management and performance sort of assessment processes, if you like, and we are midway through the development of a new evaluation policy. We're quite confident that's going to bring about a substantial improvement in transparency, but also greater use with stronger links to the design process. Finally, just to thank all speakers again, but particularly to acknowledge Scott Dawson, who's already left, and Karen Ovington. They've fronted up here before and stepped into the lion's pit to expose their work to critique, and we certainly appreciate them willing to do so again. So thank you all.
Been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.